Good evening. We are burning down the house here every Wednesday at 7 Eastern Time. Or, for my friends in London, at the stroke of midnight. So, welcome to Thursday. No, well, here in New York, we're still on Wednesday nights at heritageradionetwork.com. But you already knew that because you found us through the genius of the internet. Burning Down the House is the only weekly design show all over the planet. There's nothing like it. This evening, we're brought to you by TechServe, your number one source for everything related to the Macintosh computer on West 23rd Street in Manhattan. And they also have a really wonderful pro audio shop. I love to just drop by and play with the gadgets. It's like being here in the studio, only better, because you can buy all of that great stuff. Here, you can only use it and look at it. Drop by where we are at 261 Moore Street in the East Williamsburg Industrial Park, which is near Bushwick, two blocks from the Morgan Avenue L station in the garden of Roberta's restaurant this evening. Because we're not just limited to the high design of architecture, but rather all creative arts are brothers and sisters. You cannot separate one art from the other. Everything counts. And in this case, we're going to talk about creative arts that are on display at the Museum of Art and Design, the MAD Museum at number 2 Columbus Circle, with David McFadden, one of the curators of the current show that's up right now. Hello.
Hi there, how are you?
Very good. Well, I think you need to come a little closer.
Right. Is this better?
About a fist away would be good.
Okay.
You can adjust your stand.
Alrighty. How's this?
Oh, that's great.
Okay, perfect.
Super. Thank you for coming out to the wilds of industrial Brooklyn.
Well, thank you for the invitation.
I really appreciate it. And I was just there at the MAD Museum this afternoon looking at your show, and it's really great. I mean, I just really love it. Why don't you introduce it?
Well,
it's your show.
The title of the exhibition really says it all. It's called Dead or Alive, and it's really about the magic of creative transformation. There are 37 artists in the show from about 12 different countries, and they have made new works of art, many of them site-specific installations, using multiples of things that used to be alive. So it's things that have passed into eternity, but have been revived, resuscitated by the artist into something new and living. Shells, feathers, bones, you name it, insects.
Yeah, yeah. What interested me when I was looking at some of these pieces is they have a Paleolithic quality, because in the beginning we made art from ordinary things that we found, and we would carve on them, and that's our basic human instinct is to repurpose. Mm-hmm.
And what's on the caves of Lascaux? It's all animals.
Yeah.
The relationship with
sure.
the animal world, the living world, has been such an incredible mainstream of thought and culture and everything as we know it. And it remains so today.
Right. Well, except that we've gotten away from the direct repurpose. The cow skeleton electric bike of Billy Grace Lynn is really very interesting, because you can be riding this steer forever, although it's the cow's bones, but the bones are the bones of the bike, you know, and it says a lot about the essential structure of living and formerly breathing animals.
Right, and it also shows the diversity of approaches to making art, because Billy Grace Lynn is not only a sculptor, but a performance artist. And if you watch the video in front of the piece, she's riding that through the streets of Miami onto South Beach.
Yes.
She goes up to a drive-in window and orders a meal. I think it catches people kind of unaware.
Yeah, I know. It's great fun. Now, one of the aspects that makes your museum different is that the making of the art, the craft aspect, is very much a theme.
It's fundamental. It's really where we came from, because in our origins back in 1956, we were a museum of contemporary crafts. But in the last 10 years, when we changed our name to Arts and Design and moved to our new building, we realized that the word craft had been misunderstood greatly by the public. They thought of it as people doing hobby work or things that were more related to folk art. And we were dealing with incredible, world-renowned artists who were superb craftsmen.
Yeah.
So we focused on materials and process in the firm belief that there's meaning in the making of things. And that very simple message permeates everything we do.
Sure. Now, this Dead or Alive show is up through when?
October 24.
Oh, so all of you listeners have plenty of time from all over the world to get to New York and check it out. I mean, the incredible surgical precision of, say, Tim Hawkinson's eggshell concavities just blew me away.
Amazing.
He's taken eggshells, he's turned them inside out, and he's knit them together perfectly to make an artifact. Now, in this case, it didn't really matter what it was supposed to be looking like. It looks like a Paleolithic flaked arrowhead.
Well, think about that, because what Tim Hawkinson is saying is that what is the origin of art? It's in making these beautiful implements.
Yeah.
And he has done them from eggshells, and when you think of the title of the piece, not just being point, but also ab ovo, which means from the egg.
Yeah.
So he's also played on the material itself to give us a double layer of meaning to the whole piece.
Yeah, it's really totally brilliant. I would like to have seen that piece from behind also.
You can see it from behind if you get close enough and kind of peer around the vitrine.
Yeah, yeah. But everyone who's listening, you must go see this show. It's really, really worth getting into New York and going over to Columbus Circle and spending some time just looking at how these pieces are put together. And then there's also a very nice bicycle show,
which
we can talk about later. Now, how long have you been curating at the Mad Museum?
I've been chief curator at the museum for now coming up to 13 years. I'm starting my 13th year in about 2 weeks.
Lucky 13.
Absolutely.
And where were you before that?
I was for 16 years at the Cooper Hewitt Museum, the National Design Museum.
Yeah.
And after working at Cooper Hewitt, I had my so-called Vendriere or midlife crisis, depending on how you want to define it, and I moved out to Taos, New Mexico. And became the director of the small museum, the Millicent Rogers Museum in Taos.
Uh-huh.
Was there for 2.5 years and then came back to New York, grateful beyond belief that I was back in the city I love the most.
What was wrong with Taos?
6,500 people, and I think about that number live in my building here in New York. That explains it right there.
You were lonely.
I was lonely. I was desperate for culture.
But it was your purification, sort of a Hermann Hesse kind of thing.
You went out
to the desert and were tempted by native rituals and all that stuff.
Exactly.
Yeah.
It's getting ready to take the vow, but never putting the veil on completely.
So, I mean, does one study to become a curator?
Absolutely. I did a traditional history of art course, and here's where the interesting thing comes up about what you do when you're studying anything. Nothing is ever learned in vain. And I became extremely interested in technical theater.
Wow.
And how theater was designed. And so that led me into looking at objects very carefully, because when you're designing for the theater, every piece on that stage has to have some purpose. You can't just throw things together.
Oh, sure.
So I started looking at, why does this chair make sense in this setting or in this culture, in this context? What is this picture frame about? Is it the right period?
Uh-huh.
And suddenly I was led into a different world of design, which I've stayed in ever since.
Oh, that's super. I myself studied a lot of various aspects of theater. I collaborated on a stage set for the Dutch National Opera with Bob Israel.
Wow. I used to live in the same building he lived in. He was doing a residency in St. Paul, Minnesota, where I grew up.
Uh-huh.
And he was living in the same apartment building. So
yeah, well,
saw
we
him
did,
occasionally.
We did that show together, and I haven't heard from him since.
I haven't either. And he never said a word to me about you.
Well, I think he's... Well, I still wonder what I did to annoy him, other than be bright and young and ambitious.
Uh-huh.
It's like being in acting, I think.
Bad combination.
Yeah. That's very cool. That's very interesting. So are you from Minnesota?
I grew up in Minnesota, absolutely. One of the many, many members of the Midwestern Mafia that headed east to New York.
Yes, well, all of us ex-Midwesterners eventually find each other.
Absolutely.
Even though we're, you know, there's no registry of us, thank God, because they might just clean the streets of us. That's terrific. That's terrific. Yeah. Have you ever done any work in any of the Minneapolis St. Paul museums?
Yeah, I was at the Minneapolis Institute of Arts for 8 years.
Uh-huh.
And so I got my curatorship training coming in as a research assistant, the typical story. Yeah. In fact, I started as an intern, then research assistant, then I was offered a half-time job, and finally, uh-huh, by the time I left, 8 years later, I was full curator of what was then called decorative arts. Because
decorative
design
arts
was absorbed under this bigger rubric.
Yeah. Yeah, the whole notion that craft is macrame. I'm glad to see that attitudes towards craft are changing for the better, that it's understood that because it's crafted finally, it's not crass or commercial.
Absolutely.
Everything counts.
It comes to a really interesting, it's an interesting moment in time, because when you think about the entire revival of interest in things handmade,
mm-hmm,
the whole DIY movement, the whole cooking phenomenon.
Oh, absolutely.
Hit America.
Oh, sure.
It's all about getting back into the process of making. And I think it's become more and more important the more time we spend on the computer screen, because the other side of us, the other half of our brain, is dying to have something to touch and to taste and to smell and to get involved with.
Real and genuine and tangible.
Absolutely.
That's terrific.
So it's one of the qualities I look for in the artists we show, is that they have to be in love with the making of things.
Yeah.
And it shows in the quality of the work. When we have Keith Bentley, who's in the Dead or Alive show,
mm-hmm,
he knotted 1.4 million horsehairs,
wow,
into a piece of fabric to create his sculpture. That is a labor of not only love, but total obsession.
That's like making a Persian carpet.
That's exactly like making a Persian carpet.
I particularly also like that one room that was all covered in black feathers.
Absolutely.
That was
hundreds of thousands of feathers.
Who was the artist for that?
Her name was Susie McMurray. She's British.
Uh-huh.
We had a lot of British people in the show, actually, because it turns out the British have a very special relationship with nature, and that's always been true.
Mm-hmm.
Horses, dogs, you think
oh,
about
absolutely.
It. Bird watching.
Oh, yeah. Well, that is part of their legacy to us in this more modern age, was the arts and crafts revival.
Absolutely.
And
very much so.
And Morris and the Red House and the Pre-Raphaelites.
Correct.
Because everything counts.
And everything counts.
Let's have our first break music apropos of that. Some Depeche Mode. We'll be right back. everything does count in large and small amounts here as we are burning down the house at Heritage Radio Network. Brought to you this evening, this fine August 11th, 2010, by TechServe, www.tekserve.com. Your number one source for everything related to the Macintosh computer in Manhattan. Corporate accounts, individual accounts, technical service. Nice people. They got everything. They got the iPods, they got the iPads, they got the Macs, and they have pro audio stuff. It's worthy of a detour. Even if you're a Windows, Wintel kind of guy, you really, or girl, you got to go, you got to check it out. It will change your life. I'm here with David McFadden, the chief curator at the Museum of Arts and Design at 2 Columbus Circle, right across from Time Warner. And we're not going to talk about the architecture of the museum, which is unusual for us here on Burning Down the House, because we usually talk about architecture and design and artifact. Instead, we're going to talk about the world of museums and craft and ideas, because every art informs every other art, in my opinion. You cannot say, well, I'm a sculptor and I'm just not interested in talking about painting. Or, in my case, I'm an architect. I'm not interested in talking about... Actually, I'm very much interested in talking about craft, because the mindset, the melding of idea with execution is very, very important in my professional life. And when I see a beautifully crafted work of art, it makes my heart sing.
Absolutely. No, I think you've hit upon a really fundamental question that has been resolved more and more in the last few years. I think the best way to think about it, the old barriers and hierarchies between art, craft, and design always meant, if you imagine a triangle, art's way up at that apex. It's at the very top, and somewhere down below on the left side might be design, on the right side might be craft, but they were separate fields. In the last 10 years, because of the practitioners in every single area of the arts, that triangle has really transformed into a circle, and so there are no boundaries between them anymore. They all nurture each other, and that's what's exciting about right at this moment.
And there should not be. I mean, Titian is an incredible technician.
Absolutely.
But then we had a period of time with art that was intentionally crude, that has a little bit gone out of vogue,
right?
Which is fine.
And I think also a lot of other worlds are coming together in surprising ways, and Dead or Alive is a good example. I mean, I've always been a believer in the fact that science and art are not separate occupations.
Yeah.
And I think the interrelationships are becoming more and more apparent.
Sure.
And you think back in history. I mean, look at Leonardo da Vinci. I mean, is he a scientist or an artist? Yes.
Yes, exactly. Yes, he is one or the other, depending which day you get him.
Absolutely.
And some of our cooking people on Heritage Radio Network are true artists.
Absolutely.
And the preparation of a work of food is it's an almost zen-like process of art.
Absolutely. And I have to say, over the long course of my career, being an aging person, I have met very few museum curators that didn't love to cook. Seriously.
Well, no, I think that makes perfect sense.
It makes perfect sense. I
mean, because you're dealing with the raw elements of life.
And it's what you see, it's what you smell, it's what you taste. Yeah. It's everything that defines the quality of life, which is what good art should do.
Uh-huh. Now, for this show, how did you find these artists?
There are several ways. First of all, I had started looking for artists working with unusual materials when we moved into our new building.
Right.
And we opened with an exhibition called Second Lives.
Yeah.
Remixing the Ordinary.
Yeah, that's what really spurred my interest in talking to you because the repurposing of quotidian refuse is very dear to my heart.
So we had Tara Donovan, who built these wonderful coral bluffs out of shirt buttons. We had people working with plastic forks from the deli. They were amazing objects because they transformed them into something of great beauty. While I was looking for artists for that show, a number of people using organic materials came to the surface, and I set them aside to keep a focus. I brought those back, and then thank goodness for the internet, because once you look into a subject area, Pandora's box opens up,
and you just discover more and more. Need.
Absolutely.
Well, that's terrific. Did you commission any of those
We did.
Works?
Yeah. We've asked, in this particular show, about 12 of the objects were made for the exhibition.
Such as the cube of dead flies. I particularly found that.
Actually, she did make that before. We shipped it over, which was a real challenge, because there are probably 1,000 flies suspended on silk threads through a plexiglass box, and each one is weighted down with a little lead weight.
Yeah.
And to ship that from London was not an easy job.
I would think it would have to almost have been hand-carried on someone's lap.
Well, I wish it had been, because one of the little threads did come loose and wrapped itself around 40 others.
Oh, dear.
And one of our technicians spent about 9 hours in there with a toothpick unraveling it all. So
Teasing it free. Oh my God.
But other works, like Kate McGuire's piece called Discharge, she came to visit the museum and she looked at the architect. She saw the windows up above and said, I want to do a waterfall of pigeon feathers. And she made this incredible large-scale waterfall that you can walk under, all, by the way, with donated pigeon feathers from pigeon fanciers in England.
Yes, I saw there were stamps on them.
Many of them have telephone numbers or a little phrase saying, I'm lost, please call, because they're very valuable birds and they want to know what happens to them.
I see. So they've stamped birds so that it's like tagging them, but they've stamped it on the feathers.
On the feathers.
Yeah, that was really quite strange to see.
And then eventually the feathers fall out, and so the fanciers pick them up and mail them off to Kate, and she's got a library of pigeon feathers.
Wow. Who knew that pigeons were that valuable?
Right, absolutely, especially in New York.
Yeah, we would try to get rid of them without...
I'll tell you, in this show, one of the sort of subtle points that does come across, I think you'll look at the aspects of nature around you in a slightly different way, because pigeon feathers do become beautiful. And one other work, which is a four-part work, it's an image of a skull, the skeleton hand, a skeleton foot, and the human heart, made entirely from cockroach wings.
Oof.
And it sounds oof, but you see it, and it is so beautiful. You're just drawn into it.
I think I passed that one by. I did like the apothecary assembly of different fetishes.
Yes, absolutely.
And that gets us around to something that we were talking about before we went live, was the notion of a museum of being a treasure house. Mm-hmm. Now, I happen to be a big fan of reliquaries, and always, for me, recurrent theme that I enjoy is seeing where someone is fetishized, and it could be anything, from the medieval saints' reliquaries to Joseph Cornell's boxes, to then these apothecary bottles, and the stoppers in them had.
Each had a little symbol in the stopper.
Yeah, the craft of creating that was very fascinating to me, because if they're not glass workers, they had to have been working with a glass artist to be able to pull those off.
Well, actually, it's a collaboration between two glass artists. One, Tim Tate, who specializes in cast glass, and another named Mark Petrovic, who's a superb master glass blower. And over the course of a year, after accepting the challenge to do a new piece for the show, they came up with what they call the Apothecarium Moderne.
Yeah.
And it's 9 apothecary jars filled with unbelievable ingredients, each to solve a contemporary social ill.
And they're very funny.
So, for example, identity theft. The jar has inside it...
It was maggots, wasn't it?
No. It was skins from snakes that have been shed.
Yes,
so you've
right.
shed the skin. Yes. And then there were vials with human blood, hair, and a cut-up passport. And then the finial has Einstein's thumbprint embedded in it and inscribed around the entire...
However did they get Einstein's thumbprint?
Well, Google it. You'll find it. It's there. And then they inscribed around the side, engraved around the side, the entire human genome. So it's a marvelous
combination. That was very beautiful. That was very beautiful. Now, did they assemble the contents and then weld the bottom of the
yes.
bell jar on?
Yes. Yeah.
Because you know to get that ship model thing going there. Yeah,
no, they weren't putting it in with tweezers.
Yeah. Okay. Right. Very good. No, that was that is a brilliant piece.
It's a beautiful work.
And I have to say that it incited in me a lust to have one of those. Mm. They're beautiful things.
The other thing that comes across, and I think it's really important for the museum experience, you talk about the treasure house, and you think of going into one of the great museums of the world, the Metropolitan Museum, the Louvre, the Prado, and there is this awe-inspiring sense that you're dealing with these unbelievably important documents of culture.
Yeah.
On the other hand, I think there are other roles the museum does fulfill. And in this exhibition, whimsy and humor come into play. Those are profound human emotions.
Yeah, we don't think of going to view art or learn from the experience as being something that's going to make us laugh.
Absolutely. And I hear people in the gallery laughing out loud when they see the Mad Cow bicycle, for example. But then they read the information, the artist's statement, they realize that it has an important purpose, but it's not a crime to laugh in a museum.
Yeah, it's not a crime to be whimsical either.
That's right.
In these times when nobody's got any money.
That's right.
To have a little bit of time to laugh, to lighten up a little bit and get out of your own head into somebody else's world is a sacramental of a high order.
And Dead or Alive did something else really important. It expanded our audience dramatically. We had people who are interested in natural history who may not have been interested in art museum, but they've come to see this show.
Ah, very good.
And very I will good. Say this, because it has bones and feathers and shells and bugs in it,
sure,
kids love this show. And people bring their children and they are awestruck at how beautiful these wonderfully creepy things can be.
Well, what you've just described, however, are the basic elements that we in tribal times decorated ourselves
You've got it.
And so the big circle of history comes together, and we're all terribly modern and electronic and digital, but we're still playing with feathers.
Absolutely.
And, you probably will cause a fashion to change back to women wearing big feathery hats. And
well, I don't know about that. I haven't seen it yet.
And people walking down Fifth Avenue looking like Papageno, you know, with a suit of feathers or more snakeskin stuff.
I think at least someone might walk up to a street corner and be a little bit more forgiving of that little pigeon sitting there.
Yes. Yes, pretty bird, yeah. I think we talked about that. You did not curate the bicycle show, however.
No, I didn't. We had a guest curator, Michael Maharam,
yeah.
who has a company called Maharam Fabrics, and it's a very, very important design firm for fabrics.
Sure. Absolutely.
And Michael is a devotee of custom-built bicycles. So the show is called Bespoke, which is a little pun on terms.
Good pun.
Because they are handmade and custom-made bicycles. They are measured to fit you as if you'd had a pair of shoes made by a master cobbler.
Bespoke, yeah. And these are beautiful machines.
Definitely.
Incredibly meticulously crafted. I mean, the welds on the titanium tubes are...
And they're not fancy in that sense.
Oh,
not about decoration. It's about revealing the beautiful bones that compose any bicycle.
No, you can tell that they are machines built for a specific purpose.
Absolutely.
There are a couple of mountain bikes that have the largest mountain bike tires I have ever seen on a bicycle. I mean, they're almost like automotive tires. Mm-hmm. With this very delicate frame. that's been designed to absorb the shocks of mountain biking without shock absorbers. This excited me because I have also engineering interest, and the variations from one to the next to the next.
And even the bicycle chains look like beautiful pieces of jewelry.
God, they're so too beautiful. There's not a bit of grease on them, nor would they need it, because they're so nicely so machined. Yeah,
definitely.
And little details and the sprockets. And
what's part of an ongoing series of initiatives we've launched at the museum, which are not traditional exhibitions at all. We use that gallery to do what we call the nimble exhibitions. An idea is current, it's timely.
Yeah.
Do the exhibition immediately. Do not research for 3 years.
Yeah.
Write a ponderous catalog, and by that time it's old and out of date. We opened it with a show by the industrial designer Karim Rashid, who chose 35 of the most extraordinary heating radiators for houses you've ever seen. All in contemporary
production. One of my favorites. I mean,
and they're beautiful.
Oh,
they're
sure.
Gorgeous. And you have no idea that this simple thing can have such meaning in contemporary interiors.
Although we do see in legacy construction in loft buildings, often round radiators that encircle a column.
Right.
And you say to yourself, well, that still works.
Right.
We must salvage that.
One of my favorites was a radiator that was in the form of a steel mesh garden hose that you hung over a hook. You wrapped it up as you do with any garden hose.
Yeah.
When you needed the radiator, you took it off the hook and you stretched it out around the living room. It was a great idea.
That's a super idea. So you've taken, I mean, to extemporize here, it's appearing to me that you've taken the idea of the design collection at MoMA, the precious items, and you've taken it many, many, many layers higher, where everything that's beautifully crafted, whether it's feathers or whether it's machined titanium, is your playing field.
Well, MoMA has this incredible history of collecting icons of design.
Yeah.
And we decided it was interesting for people to not only know what the icons were, but in many instances to know how they were produced. How were they made? What was the thought process behind their creation?
No, that's good. That's good.
And so it just gives a slightly different slant on what might be viewed as the same object, but you see it differently when you get inside the mind of the designer or the maker.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I like that, because some of those design icons are a bit too precious.
And they can be very anonymous in a funny sense, because you know they're beautiful, but they don't relate directly to you. But when you see a radiator maker who is interested in experimenting with what woven mesh can do, and there are trials and errors, there are steps in this process, that's what we're interested in. Which is why on our sixth floor, we're the only museum that I'm aware of where we have open artist studios.
Studio spaces,
And every time the museum is open to the public, you go to the sixth floor, and you're encouraged to do so, and there will be an artist in residence working there, ready to talk to you, talk about their materials, their process. It just opens up another world of accessibility for understanding what we show.
And that's good, because even those of us who are New Yorkers or near New Yorkers or have been New Yorkers don't always get out to galleries.
That's true.
And galleries are not always open. I went down to the little thing in March where there were all those in Soho, and I saw some good stuff.
Yeah.
But that's a rare event. That only happens a few times a year.
It is, and funnily enough, most people really have not had a chance to talk to a professional artist. We do not, the artists in our studios make their living doing what they do.
Mm-hmm.
And even though you might have had, Aunt Martha, who was a Sunday painter, it's a little bit different when you're talking to someone who has spent 20 years really perfecting their ability to work with metal or to do something extraordinary with glass.
That's right.
And then they're open saying, ask me any questions that occur to you. And people love it.
David, that's one of the reasons why Burning Down the House exists, because in the world of architecture and design and art, and I don't separate architecture from art in
Not
any
at
way
all.
Whatsoever.
Not at all.
We just happen to have more technical challenges with varying degrees of success. People are interested, but they don't have any access to anybody who's in the field.
Absolutely.
Even I, having gone to art school, I went to Cooper Union, and I had roommates who were painters, don't have the opportunity to talk to these people as much as I would like.
Well, I think of the whole phenomenon of the cooking shows on television.
Yeah.
One of the great appeals is that you are in the kitchen with that person.
And the chef is talking to you.
Absolutely.
About what they do.
It's very personal.
But you couldn't really do that with a lot of this craft stuff unless you documented their work process in video.
Well,
or in your case, you've got the studios there.
And we have often invited an artist to create the work that will be in the gallery right in the studio. And we do one other thing which is different than most museums. Normally when a museum installs a new show, there's a big wall when you get off the elevator saying installation in progress, come back in 2 weeks,
yeah,
or whatever.
Yeah, yeah.
We leave the galleries open.
That's great.
People
oh, that's
watch
great.
The artists and the technicians
putting
installing
it
the art. And people
I would love to watch people mounting an exhibition at the Met or anywhere
Absolutely.
Else.
Because you don't know what goes on behind
well,
those
yeah.
walls. And then suddenly you see it and you realize how much time might be taken in securing a support for a heavy work of art and all the labor and engineering that goes into it.
Just hanging a photograph that's been framed properly in a gallery is artwork in itself. And you know, who knew that they use two wires on the back so you can balance it, and who knew that they were out there with their level to make sure that the labels are straight?
Absolutely.
I mean, there's an incredible amount of craft that if you haven't been around an installation, you wouldn't know. You just take it as a given. Well, there it is.
But we're saying let's reveal the process, because when people feel comfortable watching an object, a work of art, being created, it relieves them of one important pressure, because a lot of times with contemporary art, people walk out of a gallery or a museum and they feel, I must be stupid, I don't understand it. This is a way to change it. It makes things a part of what people's lives are about, and they really respond well to that.
And we can hope that in some way creates as a part of the social contract between the public in general and the world of people in the creative arts, a willingness to pay for it.
Absolutely.
Because
very important.
A lot of us feel like we're on the verge of just drying up and blowing away. Mm-hmm. All of this, this is one of my frequent rants on this program, is the trillions to bail out the banks. Where's the money for the creative arts?
Absolutely.
What about us? It's like we don't matter, but the world just gets uglier every day.
Well, we've learned an important lesson in the last couple of years, because with the big recession, of course, cultural institutions suffered a lot, and we're still suffering.
Mm-hmm.
However, it reinforced one important thing. Our biggest source of support is individuals.
That's
it's not
great.
Governments, it's not corporations, it's not foundations, it's individual givers who feel committed to participating in what a museum is about.
That's terrific, because sometimes it feels like the whole world just goes on without us.
It's true.
Apropos of which, let's roll the next break music by Peter Gabriel.
I dream of sun.
it's nothing to be there with all of you. But my own sin is so rich to protect you. Protect you. One that I love, I dream of silence. One that I love, I dream of silence. That I love as close as I can get.
As close as I can.
One that I love, I dream the same. One that I love, I dream the same. This is Burning Down the House on HeritageRadioNetwork.com, brought to you by TechServe.com, your number one source for everything related to the Macintosh computer. But you know, I like this song so much, I think we'll just let it play all the way out. Welcome back. We're here with David McFadden, Chief Curator at the Museum of Arts and Design on Columbus Circle. One of the pieces that is really just exquisite, ineffable, is, we were talking during the break, the Dandelion piece.
It's an amazing work of art. It's made by two Dutch artists, a collaborative called Studio Drift. And Lonica Gordien and Ralph Nauta are the partners in this design firm. They design furniture, they design interiors. They have been exploring in recent years the intersection between technology and nature. And the piece they created for the show is called Fragile Futures. They harvested about 200 dandelion seed heads. Mm-hmm. They were carefully returned to their studio. They removed each of the seeds from each head and re-glued it over an LED light.
So we're talking about that puffy part that blows in the wind.
That you look at it cross-eyed and it's disappeared.
Yeah, so they've taken each seed with its little feathery part and glued it back onto, they were blue LEDs.
An LED light, and then it's supported in a structure of copper.
Yeah.
And they're purists about what they do. When they harvest the dandelion heads, they will not mix seeds from one dandelion head and another. They want it to be as nature found, as nature created.
Except with a light in the middle.
With a light in the middle, but that's the intersection, technology and nature.
I'm not usually a fault finder. I thought there were too many dandelions. I would have preferred to see just one.
Well,
perhaps.
It's but very nice, but for display purposes, they made a sculpture that starts on the ceiling, crawls down the wall, goes onto a platform, and ends up on the floor.
Yeah.
So they've really taken over space, which I liked.
Yeah. Also, your lycra and knotted red thing that runs down off the ceiling.
Pantyhose and red lentils.
Yes. It made me think of sausage for some reason.
It does in a bit. It looks like a fungus has grown in the museum walls and is kind of creeping across.
But it's a very pretty fungus.
Oh, it's beautiful.
In that case.
Gorgeous.
Yes. Yeah.
Now that's another Dutch artist, and so we have a good mixture of people from all over the world.
So what comes next? You've done household items repurposed into art. Now you've got natural items into art.
We have a couple of important changes coming up. My colleague, Lowry Sims, my curator at the museum, is opening an exhibition in October called the Global Africa Project, which will look at design, fashion, craft around the world from the African diaspora. So it includes African artists working in Japan, all over the U.S.
You mean the slavery diaspora?
Well, the diaspora today, as people are moving from one country to another, because designers and artists, as we well know, no longer have territorial boundaries. So you live in many different places.
Yeah.
So that show will open in October, and then it's followed with my next exhibition, which is called Otherworldly. And it's artists who are making dioramas. And that being said, it is not what you think of as the old natural history diorama. These are truly miniature versions of other worlds. And they are incredibly complex and beautiful and often unsettling because many of the themes are very dark narratives.
I like it. But then I happen to be a science fiction aficionado. So
well, I think you'll like this one a lot.
That'll be natural. How large are these dioramas?
They range from 12 inches by 12 inch to some of them that are 6 feet long.
And Holy shit.
And many of them are made by artists as subjects of photographs. And the breakthrough in this exhibition is that we will be showing both the diorama and the final photograph. And often the photograph is the most magical transformation of that diorama. Uh-huh. There was one important criterion in selecting the artists. They could not use Photoshop. And so all these magical effects are created with light and the camera, and that's basically
And a little miniature scene.
And a little miniature scene.
How cool.
So there are things that range from inexplicable kind of Hitchcock horror stories to scenes of literally other worlds, meaning outer space, but they're all beautifully crafted, and we come back to that word.
So in a way, this is not all that different from claymation.
It's very much
work.
Related.
Yeah.
It's related, but I'm
but
not.
But this is what just one still shot and.
Or made as a sculpture in and of itself. There are several artists that just produced things such as snow globes. There are an incredible number of artists that are making artist snow globes, and they're gorgeous, beautiful things.
How nice.
And so we'll have a number of those. We've got people who are doing wall installations as dioramas. We have video artists who animate dioramas. We have one British artist who has made a zoetrope, which very few people will know, but it's one of those early movies in small actions are flashed with light, and your brain sews them together to make a continuous movement.
Like a flip book.
Like a flip book, exactly.
Mm-hmm.
So it should be a very interesting show for me.
Wow. Well, when I get some money going again, I'm going to have to join.
Well, I think you should. It's a good bargain. Once you've come back twice, you might as well buy a membership.
Yeah, and I have been there, I think, three times in the last year. I go to your place more than I go to the Met these days.
Well, I'm happy to hear that. No, I have to say, and this is being very pleased and yet very modest about what we've done since we've opened, we have had no advertising budget at all. What we have done is all word of mouth, and when people go away saying, I had a good time at the museum, they tend to tell their friends.
Yeah.
It's like the mouth meaning of any restaurant. It's what people tell you, that I had a good meal.
Oh, absolutely, because you know the person who's telling you this, and so you can judge their discernment.
Absolutely.
And that is most effective.
And we've had a lot of return visitors to see the same exhibition, which is also a bit unusual. Normally it's a one-shot visit.
Yeah.
And we've had people stop at the admission desk and say, this is my third time seeing this exhibition, which thrills us. Why and then not? We say, yes. Absolutely buy a membership. Come back every day.
Sure. You could just live there. You know, breakfast at the Mad Museum.
That's right. We got a very nice restaurant on the 9th floor, actually.
I didn't know that.
Yes.
I'll
it's open for lunch and dinner. It's open 7 days a week until 1 in the morning.
Is there a view of the park?
Beautiful view. It's one of the great views of all of Columbus Circle, all the way up to Lincoln Center,
yeah.
Central Park.
Sure.
Couldn't be nicer.
I'll have to check that out next time I come.
Good. It's called Robert.
And who's Robert?
Robert, the designer of the interior, was a very good friend of the designer Robert Isabel.
Uh-huh.
And Robert Isabel died about 6 months before the restaurant opened, so they named it in his honor.
That's nice.
So it's Robert.
Better to
Robert,
be alive. But
better to be alive, but nevertheless, he lives on in the name.
All right. Well, I think we've about come to our legal limit here. The hour goes by so terribly quickly. This has been Burning Down the House. I'm Curtis B. Wayne. I've been here with my guest, the chief curator of the Mad Museum, David McFadden. We're brought to you by TechServe, engineered by Nat Wiener, produced and tagged by Dan Brindell. That's it for August 11th. See you next week with radical talk about alternatives to architectural education. Thanks for listening. Speak with you again.